Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career. All right. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Shankelberg, your host, and today Adam Barrett's joining me. And Adam, before we get started, let me mention that my phone might ring. We woke up this morning to a dead refrigerator. It was last night and nothing this morning. So I apologize if my phone blasts away. We're expecting a call from a service guy. So hopefully your morning's going well.
Oh, totally. That's like, it's so funny. Like, it's amazing how not just the inconvenience of what's occurred, but even the inconvenience of having to deal with repair and time and scheduling time. And it affects the customers in a lot of ways. Like, do you feel differently about the brand of your refrigerator now?
Well, I'm going to pay attention to what brand it is if I have to go buy another one. This one's, I think, 4 years old. It really shouldn't have a problem. And I think that's what irks me. It could have been worse. It could have failed in the first month.
Yeah.
Yet I'm also curious, you know, when the repair guy takes the back off this thing and I'm going to be right there with him, you know, oh, let's check this. Let's look at that. Here's, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. But even if they repair it for free and pay for all the parts, there's some damage done, right? Mm. Like you've been inconvenienced.
Oh, definitely. My wife and I she's off for now, scrounging up some, coolers or chili bins, if you're from New Zealand, and some ice, because the repair guy said if we have to order a board, it'll be 2-3 days. And you don't realize how important that is until you have a bushel basket full of semi-frozen stuff.
Yeah. So what's for dinner tonight? You probably have a lot of things you have to cook, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Okay. What time? I'll be there.
Hop on a plane.
Actually, it's funny we're talking about products. You hear me use cars a lot in my examples of reliability.
Oh, certainly.
And yesterday I purchased a new car. Yeah. And so that's a very, obviously somebody said to me, they're like, Adam, I know that is no light matter for you.
That's right.
And the process is really interesting, you know, because reliability is a huge part of a car purchase. And it was kind of neat figuring out the strategies of the companies, how they approach this topic. That's something they put in advertisements as such a top contender as a factor. Mm-hmm. I know, first of all, everybody wants to know what I bought. What is the car reliability guy buy?
Okay.
I purchased a Honda Crosstour, which is based on their Honda Accord.
Okay.
And it's basically a station wagon kind of. I know people make fun of station wagons. It's like the quintessential, like, hey, I'm a middle-class, middle-aged father. This is what I drive.
It's also not as big as a minivan, and it's you can put stuff in it. You can put your kids wagons and everything in it.
Oh, I love wagons. I do. And it's actually a pretty cool one. It looks pretty cool, and it's the technology in there is amazing now. It's like you're in a spaceship. But when I was looking at cars, you know, and I was considering even, you know, Porsche. Porsche has some interesting models out now, and the interesting thing with Porsche is they have amazingly high reliability rankings. And I'm like, you know, how do they do it? Because they're pushing a lot of new technology, which creates risk for reliability. And they also kind of, you know, their cars are kind of strung out. They're trying to get the most performance out of it, which is, again, using up margin.
Right.
And I was like, how do they? And they have a mandatory annual PM. It's like a couple $1,000 preventive maintenance you have to do every year to keep everything in warranty. So that clearly is the strategy of where they were able to get such a great reliability numbers, is they force these preventive maintenance cycles that are very intense. Right. And I thought that was kind of neat, you know, because most people don't think of that as they, you know, they're assessing it as excellent engineering, but it's actually also excellent project management and strategy.
Well, which, excellent maintenance designed right in. It's
right.
Yeah.
Which leads me to the project. One of the things I wanted to talk about, you know, with you is something that I've just repeatedly with customers, you know, customers I'm consulting with, seeing this pain that doesn't need to be there. And it has to do around DFMEAs, design for MECAs. And for those that aren't familiar with them, the design for MECA is a way of analyzing your highest risks, you know, in your product and assisting with directing resource in the right spot.
Well, I remember the first time I got introduced to an FMEA study. you know, half the room had seen them before or participated in them before, and there was this groan, basically. Oh, they're so boring, or they drag on and on, or we already knew that before we went into the study, or it. And then over time, though, I've come around to it's a really wonderful tool, yet it's almost always the audience or the group that you build to do the FMEA has that dread, this perception that it's terrible.
Yeah. Oh my God. The word traumatized was used by a customer. This is a huge company that I'm speaking of that I went and did an education session for. Huge. Like everybody knows their name. A lot of people have their products. And, you know, one of the things I said is, you know, you guys are kind of with this new product and DFMEA would be really good. And the look on the face of the director was like, he's like, yeah, we kind of got into those pretty heavy last year. And he goes, I'm not sure if we're over the trauma of it. And he wasn't joking.
Oh, man.
He wasn't joking. He basically was warning me not to push it.
Don't do that. We've been there, done that.
What happened? I'm like, what happened? He's like, they literally won't end. He's like, we have whole teams that meet twice a week every month for like a year and we can't finish it. And I'm like, in my mind, I'm like, that is traumatic. Like, that's horrible.
It is horrible.
And I said, well, if for the product we're talking about right now that you have, and it's a robot, it's relatively complex. I said, I bet you we could do that in 4 3-hour sessions in total. And he just looked shocked. Well, actually, he looked like he didn't believe me.
Right.
He looked like, all right, you're not doing these right. You're going to cheat us out of what it's really worth. And, you know, and I've with another customer having a very similar conversation at the same time. But we went ahead and did the FMEA in actually 3 sessions, about 9 hours. And what I realized so clearly and what I was able to communicate with this other customer and in doing the FMEA they got to see was the mistaken intent of a DFMEA and what commonly happens. And what the intent is it's a project management tool. It really isn't anything more than that.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea being that you, in the end, you're going to rank these line items as to where you should direct your project resource. You know, you have the most critical to your product success at the top, and it's a descending order list that's ranked in the risk priority number. And that's it. You're not supposed to solve the problems in the DFMEA. You're not supposed to do fault tree analysis and get to the root cause of each one. And that's where people go off and, you know, go off a cliff.
Oh, and, yeah. And then what I've also seen is people that say, well, we don't have the numbers for that, so we need to go do experiments or we need to collect data or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the work that people don't understand that the work they're thinking of the scope should be happening outside the DFMEA. And I also recommend that they space them apart. Don't do them in consecutive days because in between, a lot of work will happen informally.
Mm-hmm.
There'll be debates and discussions that, you know, as a facilitator, I'll cut off. I'll be like, all right, guys, that's enough. Let's move on because we got the numbers we wanted from it. We don't have to go farther. But that conversation will continue and they will come back to the next session, maybe with some more information. But the whole team wasn't dragged through that technical conversation.
Yeah, and that's, you know, it's one of the things when I'm working with folks to how to facilitate an FMEA, it's look for the, I call them rat holes, right? Or two, because engineers love to solve problems. And the FMEA is, well, what could go wrong? So as soon as somebody says, oh, well, that could overheat and it would shut down. And 4 engineers around the table says, well, have you tried cooling? Have you looked at this? What about the fan flow? Where's the placement? Do we need a heat sink?
Do you know what I'm envisioning right now as you're saying this? Is you standing behind your refrigerator guy doing that?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to be so into that.
He's going to be like, all right, buddy. Did you try this? Is the fan going? Da, da, da.
That's right, right. And then when he takes the board out, I'm going to grab my voltmeter and start probing it a bunch and stuff.
So. Right. And that's what's happening in the meetings.
Oh, it is. But engineers love that kind of stuff. And as soon as you reveal... It makes part of what we do as reliability engineers so powerful is we expose weaknesses or failures. And then good engineers can do something with that. The trouble is that it's overload in an FMEA session is, let's brainstorm how many ways this can fail. And you come up with 20 ways they can fail, and the engineers want to solve all of those. We can't ship it if it's possible to fail that way. You know, it's just innate in what we do. But you're exactly right. I never thought of it as terming it a project management tool. But at the end of the day, it's just aligning our resources to the things that are most important to solve or to mitigate.
I had to explain to them, I'm like, the analysis and things you want to do, those are what the action items are. Because at the end, you know, you want action items that you can close on, you know, in the project and have this not be something that's filed away. Well, to have it not be something that's filed away, you have to have very concise, clear things that are going to be done and by who. Right. And then that's what these people are wanting to get into. And I'm like, no, all this discussion you're having is great, but this is going to be one of the action items. And here's the other thing. Maybe you shouldn't be having this discussion about this component, even though it's fascinating, because it's, you know, it's line item 150. And there's 150 items before it that are more important you talk about, which that's is right. The point of this is that to get you to talk about the other ones first.
That's right. That's right. So, and that's where the real, I think the bulk of the value is making sure you, one, beyond the three to five things that we know we got to fix or work on or improve, well, what's the next five? And if you ask the people in the room when you walk into it, you'll get 20 different candidates for what's next on the list. But then when we work it together, you know, you're successful in an FMEA when one of the team members says, you know, I didn't understand that well enough, but it is a good priority. We need to solve that.
Yeah.
And then they stop competing for resources to solve their particular issue. And they support the team's focus on the appropriate list of things to go solve.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, the metric that to me, where I really just smile and know we had a great DFMEA is when they go off and do these actions and then come back and change either the severity, detectability, or occurrence because they've done an engineering change, mm-hmm. and it changes the ranking of a line item and it moves up or down. You know, right. That's because then you know you're really getting the value of it. You've actually identified a critical issue, set out to do an action to fix it, and been able to come back and change the score and watch it move down lower. And, you know, that think about how rarely that really truly happens in a DFMEA where they'll go back a month later and open it back up and redo the ranking and scoring based on actions. And if that happens, that's fantastic.
But it is. It is. And it's as opposed to the team that you were talking to recently where they're meeting every couple of weeks for a year and they're still building the FMEA.
Oh my God, these people are so grateful when you say it's done. They're not going to go back and open it up again. Whereas the other team that met we did it in three sessions. I mean, three sessions is very, you know, this one wasn't a robot, but it was a complex device. Mm-hmm. In three sessions, we took a room of probably like 10 people through it. Everybody from executives down to entry engineers. And they have a good feeling about it. They feel like it's helped direct what they're going to do. It also brought attention to where they need resource to their management so they don't have to argue for it. They'll be like, Right. Look. You know, they'll be, look, this is line item number five. Like, they don't have to argue it. And they still have energy and excitement. And they're going to go off and do these things. And they will open it up again in a month and re-rank things.
So. That's right. That's right. Yeah. And then probably also have a discussion of what should we add. I think it's hard to stop us thinking about what can fail. What's the right next thing? Because we continue to learn things as we go off and implement changes or run experiments, we learn stuff and it may make sense to alter or adjust the FMEA or add something. That should be the exception rather than the ongoing development of it, an ongoing tedium. I certainly agree. But I like the idea of that a project management tool. I think that puts it in the right frame and it helps, I think, for me anyway, it helps me understand what the purpose is, which is not discuss every technical possible way it could fail.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. All right. Well, so far so good. Well, maybe not. The repair guy hasn't showed up. So I'll see where we're at with that and report back once I know more about how it actually failed. Do a little quick root cause analysis and see what happened.
This guy, he probably knows when he comes to the house and he's doing this for an engineer or not, right? He's like, oh God, this guy's going to be all over me.
But that's right. Well, I'm going to have the voltmeter out and you know, a bunch of other stuff out. And
Well, good luck with the refrigerator and I'm going to go enjoy my driving around my new car and it better not have a hiccup or I'll be very angry.
That's right. I'm curious, did you check recall lists and, you know, for different models and brands and stuff to see which ones are got a track record already?
Yeah, I did look at, you know, I did try to pull a lot of different information. And, you know, the funny thing is that there is, I find that I even kind of, the information was tainted by what I liked and didn't like. You know, you kind of can justify things like, oh, that's not a big deal or this. It's really funny how emotional, you know, big purchases like that are.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and, but yeah, I mean, all the info is there. And I just, the part that was just so interesting to me is I kind of got some insight into their strategy into getting higher rankings and reliability, where some of them weren't even really engineering design changes. You know, they were just other strategic methods.
Yeah, it's very true. We should come back and talk about that balance between the design and design for reliability and design for maintenance, because there's some interesting ways to approach that. And a car is a good vehicle, no pun intended, to talk about it.
Yeah. I really enjoy seeing my customers' faces light up when I tell them you could potentially dramatically improve the reliability by just not, they'll be like, we don't have time to do more with the design work. And I'm like, you don't need to. If you study the wear out and you know when to pull it out of service, mm-hmm. you've dramatically improved your reliability from your customer's perspective. Or if you figure out a wear out mode that you can do a PM, you've dramatically improved it. And you can see this light go on where they're like, holy cow, without, you know, I can't change the design, it's too late, but I can change these things and the reliability will skyrocket. You know,
That's interesting. Right. Yeah, well, we'll add that to the list and we'll come back to it.
Sounds good.
Well, thanks, Adam. And this was Speaking of Reliability. And one of the things both Adam and I have noticed is that as we get comments and reviews and feedback on that, it helps us understand what you want to hear about and what you would like to see in the show. So we look forward to hearing from you. So thanks again for listening. And thank you, Adam, for bringing up a pretty interesting topic.
You're welcome. It's always fun.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.